You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
I put my ideas into practice. That's maybe the reason why people hate me. Emir Krustria.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have Kevin Lewis, the director of the new film, Willy's Wonderland, starring the legendary Nicolas Cage. Now, I wanted to talk to Kevin about what it was like putting this project together, what it was like working with Nick as a producer and as an actor, and how he came up with this insane idea for a film, because the movie is about essentially a Chuck E. Cheese, a demonic Chuck E. Cheese that just kills people as they come inside. And Nick's character is so remarkable. I just had so much fun. It's probably the most fun you'll have watching a film this year. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Kevin Lewis.
I'd like to welcome to the show Kevin Lewis, man. How you doing, Kevin?
Doing good, buddy. How you doing?
Good, man. I'm doing as good as we can in this crazy world, man. But thanks for being on the show, man. We are going to get deep into your latest film, Willy's Wonderland, which is just insane. It's just, I can't wait to get into the deep end of the pool on that film. Before we get going, man, how did you get started in the business?
So, Alex, I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I came out to SC Film School. And it's funny, you know, even before I started the film school, I got an internship at Linda Obst at Columbia Pictures at the studio. And I worked there, and I went to film school. And from there, I interned with Rennie Harlan and John McTiernan.
During those years. Yeah. So Rennie and John were both, like, at the height of their careers, dude.
Yeah, so what's funny is I interned with Cutthroat Island and Last Action Hero. So I don't know. I'm probably not a good luck charm. But
I would get you off the set, sir. The luck charms on both those films.
But it was really cool. Like, I learned so much. I mean, at the Carloco building where Rennie was, it was so funny because, like, downstairs, it was the new guys, and it was Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin. And, you know, it was like they just did Stargate.
Right.
And I was in charge of, like, you know, the scripts and, like, reading scripts and coverage and stuff. And, man, you know, I would also be in charge of taking the scripts down the infirmary and on this red wagon. They were just piled high, and I would have to put them in the fire and burn them. And you just felt so guilty, kind of depressed, because I was like, I was just seeing all these writers and, you know, and actually some of them are pretty big now, you know, but you're putting their scripts in the fire and just watching this great work and sweat, blood, sweat, and tears go up in flames. It was like, welcome to Hollywood, kid. You know,
I never actually knew there was an actual bonfire that they actually put things in.
It was. I took them in, and so yeah. But I learned a lot there, and then I right out of film school, I made my first movie, The Method, with Sean Patrick Flannery and Robert Forster and Natasha Wagner, and we went slam dance with it, you know, and. So that was my first movie, and we big borrowed and stole. I got a Panavision camera from Panavision. They let us have that, you know, and I shot it in a couple weeks, you know. And
this was I think you probably shot this in, what, 95, 96?
Yep, 95,
so,
yeah.
So
yeah.
There was no Red, there was no Alexis. It was 35 or nothing at that point.
Yeah.
When you were coming up, when you were interning for Rennie and John, you were telling me off air that you also had a couple run-ins with Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Lucas as well.
And, yes, I did. So I was on the set of I was at Sony, and that was when they were shooting Hook and Dracula. They did Dracula after Hook, and I ran into Mr. Spielberg and asked him if I could hang out with him and John Williams, and they were working on some of the post, and he had cheeseburgers in his hands. He said, we're keeping it kind of private, but thanks, you know. And like I said, you know, he could have a security guard escort me out, you know, but he was so nice. And then, you know, Dracula, I snuck on the set of Dracula and thinking, yeah, I'm going to sit watch Gary Oldman work, and it's going to be amazing. And it was about 5 seconds before the first AD was like, get, what are you doing here? You know? But those were magical times, man. The studios were bustling, making movies. It was pretty incredible. And, you know, another cool thing, too, was when I graduated USC, Spielberg and Lucas were the speakers at the graduation. They were getting honorary degrees, and they spoke to the whole graduation class. And then they went to the film school and spoke and then gave out our diplomas. So I went and shook both of their hands, and I told Spielberg, he's the reason I'm here. And he said, knock him dead, kid. And that was just really, really special. I'm not a big like autographs and things like that, but I'll tell you another thing. One of my favorite directors, Sam Raimi. And so when I came out here at Shrine, they used to have the conventions at the Shrine, pop culture conventions. And so we went, and he was signing Army of Darkness, and I got the cool exclusive poster with Bruce and everything. And he signed it, and he said, you know, Kevin, looking for your name on the big screen. Keep them rolling, Sam Raimi. And then I was like, wow. And then down the road, Bruce signed it and said, Kevin, ignore what this guy says below. But I still have the poster framed. And it's just, you know, yeah. I'm not a big autograph fan. Like I said, my grandfather was Tom Tully, and he was in the Caine Mutiny with Humphrey Bogart. He was actually the captain that Humphrey Bogart replaces. And he was known for a lot of World War II movies. He was like the Tough Irishman, Destination Tokyo and stuff. And interesting enough, he got blacklisted, him and like King Vidor. John Wayne actually asked him, are you going to vote for McCarthy? It was all that era. And he says, none of your business. And so they labeled him a communist. And he didn't get work for years. And then he got picked up work with Danny Thomas at a variety show and hired my grandfather. But why I'm saying that is because I remember growing up with my mom, and she had books of these autographs of her, Charlton Heston, her as a little girl, like all these amazing actors, and Cary Grant, all of these just incredible on their lap. And so I just would look at it, you know, and it'd be like, you know, they're autographs, you know. And so I was just never a big fan, but with Sam Raimi, that was just something special, you know. And of course, meeting Mr. Lucas and Spielberg, you know, like, come on, right?
Right, so. Exactly. I'm not a big autograph guy either, but like I was telling you before, and like I got that Kira Kurosawa autograph in the back. I didn't actually get him to autograph it in front of me. I wish that would have been a thing, but I just bought because it's a Kira Kurosawa. The only other autograph I would probably ever want to buy is Stanley Kubrick, and that would probably be. And I've looked into it, and I'm like, I can't really justify that price right now.
What's your favorite Kubrick film?
This is I love Eyes Wide Shut, man. I absolutely love Eyes Wide Shut. I'm a fan of, all of his films, but for whatever reason, Eyes Wide Shut really got underneath my skin and has stayed there ever since I saw it as an adult. I saw it when it came out in 99, which was a quote unquote adult. I was in my 20s. I didn't count that as an adult yet. In my life, at least. But Eyes Wide Shut, there was just something about that movie really just got into me. And all of his films just take a hook into you. I watched Clockwork Orange like a year ago, and I was watching the first 20 minutes. I'm like, it's like a 20-year-old did that today. It's insane.
Oh, yeah.
No way. Can you imagine a studio releasing that today? Can you imagine?
No. No. And one of my favorite movie is 2001. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
And it's so funny because I was talking to a friend of mine. I'm like, okay, so if they did 2001 today, like the Dawn of Man sequence is cut, it's gone. It opens up, and they're checking the monolith out. The monolith's attacking, right? And it's like attacking the first 30 minutes of the movie. And you got Clooney, right? You got Clooney, and like the voice of the monolith will be like Brad Pitt or something, right? You know, and then the Star Child sequence, forget that. Like that's done. You know, this huge fight between two wars and CGI. You know, like. Yeah, it would never make that movie ever. That's my favorite movie.
It's a miracle that movie got made when it got made, and it only made a lot of money because of the time it came out. People started getting high and tripping and going to see that movie, and it became a huge hit. It found this
young college kids. They would go. Yeah, college kids. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's how it became so.
They would get.
Dude, we could talk about.
They would get high. I know we got so much to talk about.
Oh no, man! I could do a whole Kubrick. I mean, I could talk to everyone. Everyone who listens to the show knows my love for Kubrick, and I've gone deep, 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 deep down the rabbit hole of Kubrick. So I could talk for days about his filmography, go into the deep crevices of it. But anyway, so I wanted to tell you about The Method, your first film. You worked with Robert Forster. I worked with Robert as well. On a film that I did, and I you worked with Robert pre Jackie Brown, so he was Robert Forster, but people had forgotten about him, and he was the first to say this, and that was before Quentin kind of pulled him back out and like, hey everybody, this is a really good actor you guys should be looking at.
Yes. Yeah.
So you worked with him before. I worked with him in 2010, and my God, man, what a pro. Did he give you the letter opener?
You know what? No, actually, he did not.
But you know that story, right? You know that story.
Yes, yes. He gives that, yes. So what's interesting is he came on, and it was funny because he's like, hey, Kevin, he knew this was a low-budget movie, and he's like, I would have done this for free if I would have known, And it's like, oh, no. But it was so funny. So I'm sitting there, and I'm working with him. And I'm like, okay, so, Sean's going to come in here and you're going to, and I just stopped. And I was like, oh my God, you were Dan from the Black Hole, And he's like, yes, I was, Kevin, And I'm like a geek moment, Black Hole. I love Black Hole. I don't care what anyone says. I love that movie. I have all the figures. John Barry's score is awesome.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, I could go total like Chris Farley here. I got to like rein it in. So I was like, okay, well, that's cool. Okay. So anyway, but I was like, oh my God,
it just dawned on you because before this is pre IMDb. So you're really not really like,
it's totally.
And then you just like, oh, wait a minute. You were in the black hole. Oh,
yeah. Cause you threw like a line reading with me, And I was like, okay. And then, okay, Robert. And he's like, I was like, oh my God, And he was just he was just the coolest. And I would run into Robert. At that time, he was telling about Quentin. He was going, I think, to Swingles or Single. It was Swingers. It was in L.A. It's the diner. And he was meeting with Quentin. Okay. And Quentin was talking about, the script and he's going to do it. And he was like, we'll see. You never know, whatever. And how cool is Quentin, man, to do that, And I was so happy for him.
I heard Robert was telling me when we were working together, he's like, I go, how was it to like get onto, like, how did you get on Jackie Brown with Quentin? Because it was, I mean, it's Quentin's second movie. Yeah. I mean, third movie.
Yeah.
And basically he could do whatever he wanted after Pulp Fiction.
Like, yeah.
He could have done anything and he picked Jackie Brown to do it. And he's like, Robert tells Quentin, Quentin's like, I think I'm gonna cast you as this part. He's like, Robert tells Quentin, he goes, Quentin, I don't think they're gonna let you cast me in this part. It's too big. And Quentin turns to him and goes, I cast whoever I want. And at that moment, Robert goes, oh, I'm back, baby.
Oh, that's great. That's so Robert. That's awesome.
He was just
that's
like,
great.
Oh my God. I think I'm going to get another shot at this. And he wrote, I mean, Oscar nomination, and he had an amazing career from that point on. I mean, and even his last performance in the Breaking Bad movie that was on Netflix. Or I think that are amazing stories. Because anytime I see Robert, I just stop and watch him.
Yeah.
It was so amazing to work with him. At that point in my career, which was looking like, 12 years ago when I was working with him, I'd worked with good actors, but I hadn't worked with someone like Robert yet. And when you work with a guy like him, like, he came in prepped. He had taken time. He'd worked hard. And you're just like, that's an old school, like, just...
class act. That's right. Old school. That's right.
Class act, craftsmanship. And he came in and he just... And I directed him 2 or 3 takes. He was doing VO for me on this thing. And he's like, are we done? I'm like, we were done on the first one, Robert. I just kind of wanted you to see you
work. So
it was just like so amazing.
Great.
It's so amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But so that was our connection to the method.
So cool. That's great. It's a great connection.
So, man, your new film, bro, Willy's Wonderland. You know, I literally just watched it before we came on the scene because I wanted to be really fresh on it. Dude, how the hell did that movie come to life?
Well, it's really interesting. Jess Davis, who played Siren Sarah, she was in an acting class with Geo Parsons, who wrote the script. And she first read the script. And she took it to her husband, Jeremy Daniel Davis. And he read the script and he loved it and he optioned it. And then he brought it to me and I go back with Jeremy way back. And, you know, I love to tell this story. I did a movie called Malibu Spring Break. It was for Crown Entertainment. And that, you know, in the '80s, they were known for like My Tutor and all the TNA movies, Galaxina. That was like their Star Wars. And, I wrote the movie in like 2 days, 3 days. And I shot it 9. And you know, when you're working, you know, looking, you know, director looking for work, man, you know, you take it, you know, and, I just really believe like the more you get behind the camera, the better. And it's not like now where you can go and shoot something with a Red or your iPhone. It's like you said, Alex, it's like, it was a 35 millimeter. I shot Malibu Spring Break 35 millimeter. You know what I mean? So, anyways, I did that movie and I met this actor, Jeremy. And I put him in. It was his first movie. And he's great. He's young kid or whatever. And I promised him this scene that we were going to do, like an improv scene. And near the end, the producers want to wrap it up and whatever. And I was like, you know what? I promised him this thing. I'm going to do it. And we did it. And flash forward years later, I'm working on another project. I'm working with another producer. And he's like, yeah, I'm, you know, Jeremy. And I was like, Jeremy Davis? He's like, yeah. And Jeremy came in and we reconnected. And he actually tried to help me with this movie I had Mads Mikkelsen attached to do. And he tried to help me with this film. And, you know, unfortunately, it didn't pan out. So years later, Jeremy brings me Willy's, you know. And what's funny about that, it's like, if I didn't do Malibu Spring Break, I wouldn't be here talking to you, buddy, you know. And you know, everybody sometimes like, well, you know, you shouldn't do this. I remember an agent told me, your career is, you know, going to be defined on the work you turn down rather than the work you do. And I was like, I think that's the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life, right? Like, who's going to know what you turn down? Like, and I was just not in that, you know, I wasn't in that position to turn it down. And anyways, the point being, and, you know, it's funny because I made the method and it went to Slam Dance. It got distribution. It did okay. And then I made a movie called Downward Angel. And with Matt Schultz, who did Fast and the Furious, and actually we cut a I cut a reel for him and to show Rob Cohen so he could get that job, and Jonathan Banks from Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And we made that movie. And what was cool that at that time, Blockbuster was alive and well. And so we made it, you know, for a really low budget. And we sold the Blockbuster for like four times as much. And actually, there was a Hollywood Reporter, and it said the Killer Bees. And it was the president of Blockbuster. And he had Contaminated Man poster with William Hurt on one side and Downward Angel on the other, you know. And it's like, it was just the coolest, you know. So I did that. And I worked my way. And then, you know, I did Malibu. But, you know, like I said, I wouldn't be talking to you here. It wasn't for me. And so when people say, well, if they're filmmakers, well, should I do this? Well, yes, you should. You know, go out and make movies, whatever you can do. Now the technology is there. You don't need, you know, the 16 mil and the 35, which are great. But you don't need it now. You have an iPhone even, you know, like go write your scripts, work on your stuff, you know, if that's what you want to do. So I was in that mentality of just, you got to do it. You want to do it, you do it, you know, by any means necessary. And that's how I've always kind of operated.
Yeah. So, I mean, and perfect example is Peter Jackson, you know, his first film, which I forgot what the name is. Is it Stay Alive or Bad Taste? Bad Taste.
Stay Alive.
No, Bad Taste.
Bad Taste. Yep.
Bad Taste. And he did this, which is exactly what its title is. It's extremely bad taste. It's a really schlocky horror, bad horror, B movie level kind of effect. And yet he goes on to do the Lord of the Rings, wins Oscars and all that stuff. And I remember hearing the story. I heard the story that Peter Jackson, when he got hired by Bob Shea at New Line to do Lords of the Rings, Bob Shea hadn't seen Bad Taste yet. So he signed the deal, he's prepping, and then all of a sudden someone walks in and is like, yeah, this is your director. And they showed him Bad Taste. And he's like, oh my God, what have we done? And they're like, holy cow. So, but obviously it worked out. But, you know, that was, I mean, because from Bad Taste to $450 million, shooting three movies in a row that no one really had done anything at that level before. It was an insane thing. But I agree with you 100%. I did a lot of stuff when I was coming up as a director, as an editor.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff that just whatever. Hey, man, pay the bill. Gotta, you know, hustle.
Yeah.
Pay the bill.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, and again, it's like you talk about Peter Jackson, and I'm not comparing, you know, it's so funny. We live in this world now where to me, everything, you have to put kind of a disclaimer, right? So it's like, I'm not comparing myself to these guys, okay? So I'm not. Sure. But, you know, James Gunn started with Troma, right?
Yep.
You got James Cameron doing Piranha, right? Roger Corman and, you know, Piranha. I mean, it's like, you got to start out somewhere. I mean, not all of us could be, and I, God bless him, and I love him, and he deserves everything, like Christopher Nolan. You know, like every movie the guy does is just amazing. Even Following, his first movie I loved, you know? And so, you know, I mean, and so that's the thing. It's like, there's just so many different ways, right, in this business and how you do it, you know? And I always felt like I was going to work myself up. I was a workman's director. That's how I felt, you know? I wasn't going to be this guy who just makes Wonder Kid, you know, early and just hit this movie and be, I just never felt that, you know? And so it's so refreshing to have Willie's, because, you know, I never really had a budget on my movies. And even this movie is not big budget compared to what we talk about and what movies everyone sees. What's funny is one of my films, Dark Heart, I was at a film festival, and I remember everybody leaving, and I heard someone saying, well, I like Dark Knight better, you know? And I was like, well, you know, I like Dark Knight better too. It's Christian Bale and Christopher Nolan, you know, and Heath Ledger, and it's a $200 million movie, right? So mine was the catering budget. There wasn't even the catering budget on that. So the thing is, it's like, you know, now I've got Willie's, and, you know, again, then I shot in 20 days. Okay.
Nice.
20 days. And you'd appreciate this as a director. I did a 70-page shot list for every sequence of the movie, the whole script shot listed, shot for shot.
And how much of it did you actually get in the can?
About 85%.
Nice. That's really good. Because I always show up with, like, I got 50 shots for this scene.
Yeah.
And then the first AD goes, that's nice. And then at the end of it, you're like, yeah. I got 20%.
So I always
over prep on certain scenes. It's just a dialogue scene.
We had that. The first AD was like, Kevin, you got a 40-day shoot here, you know. But the thing is like I condensed them, whatever, but it's still with the shot list coming in. Yeah. And you know, it's so funny too, because we were talking about it's like Lawrence of Arabia in the morning and then Dukes of Hazzard in the evening. So it's like, you know, you're sitting up these shots for the punch to pop, these beautiful shots, you know, and then you realize after lunch you still have 5 pages left, right? So you're like, all right, let's just handheld here. We're gonna get handheld and we're gonna run around, you know. So I knew, like, going in, I'm like, no, I don't want to fall in that trap.
That's a great analogy. Lawrence of Arabia in the morning, Dukes of Hazzard at night.
Yeah, totally right. And so basically it was like would work with my DP and the production designer and everybody, and everyone was on the same page on this film, and everybody showed up with a smile on their face in the morning and left at the evening. And I feel like you can tell on the movie, like, we were having fun. It's a very self-aware movie. You know, it's called Willy's Wonderland. I'm not trying to make some big statement about the universe, you know. I just want people to have fun, you know, check their brain at the door and just go on the ride with Nick and these 8 crazy psychopathic animatronics, you know. And
so for everyone listening, because not everyone has seen the trailer yet or seen the movie, can you tell us what the movie is about?
Okay, so yes, it's about this drifter that drives up into a small town. His car breaks down. He needs to get it fixed. And he has no money, and so they make a deal with him. They're opening this kid's place, like a Chuck E. Cheese wannabe, called Willy's Wonderland. It was a defunct, you know, it was opened decades ago, and they're reopening it. And they say, hey, can you clean it for us? If you clean it for us, we'll get your car fixed. He agrees, and he goes in, and mayhem ensues, you know. And they got the wrong guy. They got Nick Cage. So.
Right, exactly. And when mayhem ensues, it's basically killer animatronics coming after, like possessed. Yes. Killer animatronics coming after him. So the concept is a very high concept. It's pretty straightforward. Not a lot of
high concept, right? You know,
it's straightforward. What I did love about the movie, you're absolutely right. It is extremely self-aware. So it's not like watching The Room, which is completely not self-aware, and it doesn't know.
You see that, Bob. I really want to see that. I love Franco's movie, The Disaster Artist.
You've never seen The Room?
No, I've never seen it. I it's on my list. The Disaster Artist reminded me of the days, like we were talking about, making The Method and all the glorious 90s. Like, it just, I love that movie. So I just want to see The Room.
All right. So when I talk, all right. So everyone now is going to go, oh God, he's going to get into The Room now. I'm not going to get into The Room, guys. But I've been fascinated with The Room. This is what you have to do. You can't watch The Room alone. You can't. It will be a horrible, horrible, horrible experience. So either if you can't have people over, do it virtually.
Yeah.
But if you cannot talk to other people, and it's even better if you can talk to other filmmakers. If you can talk to other filmmakers while you're watching it, that's what makes the movie fun. Because if you just sit and watch it, you're like, this is really bad. Like, this is extremely bad. And everything you see in The Disaster Artist is it's all true. All true. And I'll tell you my connection to The Room after we get off air, because the audience has already heard it. But yes, don't, that's a mistake. Don't ever watch it alone. Like, I made the mistake of watching Troll 2, which is a really bad, another one of the worst movies of all time, by myself. And I felt dead inside when I left. No, I swear to God, I felt like a little bit of my soul was taken from me when I watched it. It was so horrendously bad. I was offended to my soul, and I felt dark inside. It was just like, it's so bad. It was not like The Room. Like, when you watch The Room, you feel so good. That's why it keeps going, because people love it. It's so much fun, and it's so ridiculous. Yeah. Anyway, again, all right, we'll stop about The Room. So now we're back to Willy's Wonderland. So
yeah, let's go back.
So dude, how the hell did you get Nick Cage, man? Like, and before you answer that, can we all agree that Nick Cage is a national treasure? Let's just put that right out there right now. Nick Cage is a national treasure.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. now back to the show.
For sure. He's a genre to himself, right? I mean,
that's awesome. That's a great way to get in the case.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, okay, what do you got? Well, I got a sci-fi movie, I got a horror movie, but I got a Nick Cage movie. It's like, oh, okay, give me the Nick Cage movie, right? So basically what happened is, you know, Gio wrote the script. He did a great job with the script. We developed it with him, Jeremy and I. And, you know, we got a casting director. We made an offer to his manager, Mike Nylon. Mike Nylon liked it and passed it to Nick, and Nick liked it. And they became producers on it. And I just tell you right now, I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Nick is three things, man. You know, we know he's an Academy Award winner. We know he's an amazing actor. Like, that's like done, right? But he is a fantastic partner to do a picture with, to work with day to day, to try to get something off the ground and make it, and then shoot it with him. Like, amazing. Him and Mike, every step of the way, supportive. And the third thing is, he's just a damn good guy, man. Like, Nick is the real deal. He is solid. I'm a big believer in chi. That may sound corny to people, but when you meet Nick, you can just feel the energy. And he's true, man. He's no BS. You know, Alex, there were times, man, like, and you'll appreciate this again, making films. Like, we would set up with second team, and I'd have this double in, you know, and this double or stand in. And it'd be like holding the punch pot, because we'd be, you know, checking the focal length with the lens, all that. Nick would just come in and hold it. Okay. He wasn't in his trailer. You know, he was there with us, the camera crew, right there. He wasn't in a video village. He was there. And I can't tell you how supportive. We didn't get in one creative disagreement. We saw the movie eye to eye. He worked his tail off, you know, with the fight scenes. Was there in the gym in the mornings, just working it, man, you know, never late to set, you know, always on time, always prepared, always ready to go, always pushing, always trying to figure out how we do it the best way. Like, I've got nothing. I mean, I could just go on and on for hours about Nick Cage. He deserves everything he has and more. I love that guy, and couldn't have made this movie without him, you know, really.
And what I love about Nick, man, is he is a national treasure, and he is, and now he's become, I don't know if he's always been this, but he's very self-aware of who he is, and his brand, and what he's doing. He's extremely self-aware of that. I mean, he just did that Netflix show, The History of Curse Words, which is like, well, of course Nick Cage has to host that. Like, of course that has to do that.
And he's a movie lover, man, like us. Like, he'll be here, and he loves movies, you know, and that's what you get with Nick too. It's like, he's a film fan just like us, man, you know, and he gets it, you know. A lot of actors would have shied away from this part, you know, and it's a challenging part. And I was so happy that I just knew. I had a gut feeling, Alex, that he was going to want to do this movie. I just think he's going to get it. He's going to get it. You know, and a lot of actors, I don't think would have, you know?
Right. And he was like, and it's right down his alley. I mean, this is a strike.
Yeah.
Right down the middle of Nick. I heard a story with Werner Herzog when he was directing Nick in Bad Lieutenant 2.
Oh, yeah.
New York.
Yeah.
He said that, and I think this was in his masterclass, even Werner's masterclass. He was saying a story that he went on set, and he didn't have a shot lit. Like, it's Werner Herzog.
Yeah.
So he was doing stuff that was a little bit, and if you remember that movie, it's pretty off.
The iguana, right? Was it the iguana? Was that, all this kind with of a wide angle lens? I would love it. Yeah.
All that kind of craziness. And and I think there was rumble. I think the crew wasn't with Werner. And I think he was fighting the crew a bit, if I remember the story correctly. All I remember after that is that at lunch or something like that, Nick got up on the table or on top of the car, and he addressed the entire crew. And he's like, I'm finally working with a director who's got a set of balls on him and who's brave, who's a true filmmaker, and blah, 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 and just completely built him up. And it's Werner Herzog. I mean, at that point in his career, he's still Werner Herzog.
Sure.
But Nick wanted to support what this madness that Werner was doing, because that's the kind of, look, you sign on for Werner Herzog movie, that's what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
It's like signing on to a Terry Gilliam film. Like,
yes.
Yeah. You know, don't look for Goodwill Hunting. Don't look for Goodwill Hunting if you've got Warner or Terry. Yeah. You're going to get those different kind of films. So that's,
that's why you hire these guys. That's why you hire these guys. Yeah. No, I totally believe it. You know, another great story with Nick is the last day of shooting for him, for lunch, he hung out in the dining room, the set, and he signed anybody and everybody's stuff from the cast and crew, posters, DVDs, whatever. He took his whole lunchtime to do it, pictures with everything. I mean, that's just, I mean, come on, right? Like, he's just the coolest.
That's amazing. All right, so we were talking earlier about you directing Robert and going, oh my God, you're the guy from The Black Hole. What was that moment for you with Nick? Because I'm assuming, you know, there's a couple of movies in Nick's filmography that you probably are a fan of. You're just like, holy cow, I'm directing Nick Cage. How does that work within yourself as a director? Yeah. How did you deal with that? And what was there a moment? Because you were working with him as a producer, did you geek out? At what moment did you finally geek out? Or did you never geek out in front of him?
No, it's cool. Like when I met him, I felt like he really clicked. And he did a wardrobe, you know, and we got the Willie shirt on him and we were picking the jacket and everything. And I just felt really good. We walked around set showing him. I mean, I know it was Nick Cage, but you know, he's an actor in the movie and he's carrying the movie. I was explaining to him the vision of it. I gave him my shot list, you know, I was like, hey man, here, you know, yes. I mean, there's parts of you that go, oh my God, it's Nick Cage. But I knew that we had a movie to do. And the coolest thing for Nick was like the first day. So the first day we shot all the driving stuff, okay, outdoors. Because that week we shot everything outside Willie's because we were still getting Willie's prepped for this on the soundstage. And I'll never forget, Alex, I did the first take and it was just awesome. It was him with the drinks and whatever. Well, the first take actually was him with Emily giving the punch pop. And I was like, that was great. And then we got him doing the whole opening with the car and stuff. And I'll never forget when I said, man, Nick was great. Look at this shot. And it was the wide shot of the car and him with the tree. And he was looking at it. He goes, oh, this looks great, whatever. And I'll never forget when he's like, well, we're in it now. And I was like, yes, we are. Like, we're in it now. And you could just tell, like, it's just, he's such a team player, man.
And I've heard stories of guys at his level. First of all, no one's at Nick's level because he's got his own level.
Sure.
But actors who are accomplished, who are at that kind of, you know, box office level. Who are not team players, who are nothing but pains in the asses. Who help destroy films that they're on because of their attitude and their work ethic and things like that. That's great to listen to.
Oh man, it's so funny because a couple of weeks ago I read an article. It was the director of Hoosiers and he was talking about Gene Hackman, and I love Gene. I think Gene Hackman is a national treasure. I love Gene, man. And I was reading this article and it was just like Gene made everything miserable, I guess, you know. And I was reading it. I was just reflecting on myself and going, well, how would I have handled this? Right. And I was like, God, Nick was just so the opposite, you know, and, you know, he spoiled me, man. Like, you know, and I've worked with other actors and divas and things like that. And so I kind of know that too, but, man, it's like, you know, life's too short, you know, to do that in my book. I like happy sets, man. I like when the crew enjoys each other and we're like a family. You know, I just feel like the best work comes from that. There's other directors that like chaos. They just work in chaos, and that's who, or actors or whatever, like that's what they do. And they thrive on that, you know, but I'm a very positive person. I like positivity. I'm not a big fan of the negativity. Especially, you know, I was, you know, I'm lucky to be here, you know, talking to you. I was in the hospital with COVID pneumonia and I almost didn't make it, buddy.
Oh man. I'm sorry to hear.
Yeah. I was in it for 2 weeks and, I got released right before the movie came out. I was in bad, bad shape. And, you know, it really just brought everything to light on so many levels. But the point is that life is just too dang short, man. Mm-hmm. You know, and I used to like even stress out, like all the movies coming out, like I got to see everything. You know, I'm not a film fan and whatever. I don't see everything and stuff. And it's like, there's so much out now with content. And I was really worried about Willie's. Like, how do we break through the mold, right? How do we how do we do that? And I was like, you know, Kevin, just stay true and just make the best movie you can, you know? And so like now it's like, you know, there's so many films, like I don't even care about it anymore, man. Like I can't see everything, you know, I can't do it. It's like, I look at my Blu-ray collection steelbook. I'm a huge physical media fan, you know? And I'm like, you know, if I just sat down and watched all these movies again, I wouldn't make it, right? You know, like, so it's like, I just, you know, like working with Nick and stuff, you just enjoy those moments, man. Like that was such a, it was an amazing time. It was before COVID. I mean, we wrapped February 28th. I was on a plane back home to Orange County March 1st on a Sunday. And in 2 weeks, I believe, COVID, LA shut down. I went to the cutting room that Monday and worked with my editor for 2 weeks. And then we were shut down. So we all had to do this movie remote post, you know?
Wow, man, that's crazy. And then when you actually... the one thing I was going to say, I love Nick's character in it. And by the way the movie breaks through, it's extremely simple. It's Nick Cage beating the hell out of Chuck E. Cheese. I mean, let's just put it.
That's a pitch, buddy.
That's the pitch. You had me at hello. Like, it's like, okay, got it. Fine. Yeah. But what I love about Nick's character is, one, he's never had to memorize less dialogue because he... You know, he doesn't have dialogue in the movie at all, which I'm assuming probably also as an actor, he probably was like, has he ever done a movie? He has no dialogue. I don't think he ever has.
No, I think that was one of the attractions he wanted. He was channeling Charles Bronson from Once Upon a Time in the West. That's one of his favorite movies. Oh. And and then we were talking about other films. Like, again, I love Drive. Like, it's one of my favorite movies of the decade. Oh. Like, I love that movie. And if you think about Ryan Gosling's character, like, he doesn't talk much, but he does talk, okay? Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I was thinking like Mads in Valhalla Rising, you know, mm-hmm. like he doesn't talk a lot, but I think at the end he does. Or so. But I was like, God, what? I don't know, man. You know, we're film buffs. Like, have you thought about how, you know, could you count on five fingers how many characters in films have not talked? Like, I think it's pretty rare, right?
It's extremely rare, especially having an actor of his caliber doing it as well, which I can't remember an actor not speaking at all in the entire film, other than the occasional grunt, that's a Nick Cage grunt because I've heard that 1,000 times.
So
when he's fighting, which is great. But I also love about Nick's character in the movie is, which he's called, just called the janitor. There's no name to it. Or not the janitor, is it the janitor? I saw the credit.
Yeah, janitor. He's the janitor.
A janitor, which is great. Yeah. But that he is never scared.
Yeah. Never.
He's just so a matter of fact about it. That is such a, and I don't know if that was in the script or if that's something that you brought to the table, or if that was you and Nick, but I love that he's not fazed that there's a giant animatronic creature trying to kill him. He's like, oh, pop, 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 pop. I got to take my break. And like, it was just so wonderful. Everyone else freaking out, but he's just like, gotta go.
I love that too. And that was in the script. And I, you know, it's funny because you see reviews and it's like, I wanted to see Nick Cage running around, like, you know, hiding from these guys and like figuring out how to fight. Like, who wants to see that, man? Like, I don't. I don't. And so,
That's not this movie.
No, this movie. So the buzzwords for me every time I was like, all right, we're making this movie. It was always punk rock and a rave at 2 a.m. Like, that was like my vibe of this movie. And it was a midnight movie. It was a movie when we went and saw Evil Dead 2. We drove 1.5 hours out to see it in some Bodunk theater. Right. That was it. It was a midnight madness film. That's what I wanted on this movie. And I love that he's not flinching and everything. I just think that's great. It turns the genre kind of on its head, to be honest with you, you know, because that's what you're expecting, right? You're expecting hiding out or whatever. And then they're going to work on like, we'll have a MacGyver scene where they build the weapon to fight the creatures, you know, and A-Team where they got, you know, like,
that's like my favorite part of A-Team too, though, because they shot.
Totally.
They were horrible shots. I think one person died in the entire series. I still remember it because it was such a shock when someone died. I think someone was thrown out of a window and that guy died. I'm like, wait a minute, someone died? Like, it freaked me out.
Totally.
Because no one ever, there was never even a grave. There was never even a blood.
Totally. And it was always the montage with the music and Mr. T, like, Peak of the Metal, you know, and George Peppard, you know. So, like, we could have totally had that, like, Nick's hiding out, you know, and then he's got the kids, and then they're going to be like, no, this is Nick Cage, man.
That's a different... Yeah. You leaned into this so well, because other directors might have pulled back and said, you know, I need that scene where Nick is fighting. Like, no, you understood the story. Nick understood the story of, like, look, Nick Cage versus Chuck E. Cheese. That's at the end of the demonic Chuck E. Cheese. That's it, guys. This is not deeper than that. Let's go down that road. And if you nail that, you've got a strike.
Embrace it, right? Embrace it. That's how I felt too. Like, you know, I had 20 days to shoot, like I said. And so, you know, I didn't care if we had a shopping cart, like, to use it for a shot. Like, I don't care, old school. Like, we're just, we're going to get these, you know? And that's kind of how I did it. And let's turn our weaknesses into strengths. You know, I don't have a techno crane. Okay. I don't have all the fun, these tools. I don't care. We'll figure it out. What does Sam do, you know, and how inventive he was, right? And so that's how I kind of approached it, you know, and I approached it really with the, you know, one of my favorite movies about making movies is The Big Picture with Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon, yes! What an amazing,
I love that movie.
Amazing movie about making movies. Oh, what a
Christopher movie. Guest, I think, directed it. I love that movie. And I remember the poster, I have it, and he's in the shopping cart with a camera, you know? Yeah. And that was like my, every time I thought about it, like, that was Willie's. That's how I wanted to do it. I wanted to do a grindhouse, you know, just old school practical effects, you know, 80s vibe, you know, Return of the Living Dead, Evil Dead, all those, you know, and even though it doesn't take place in the 80s, it's just got the soul, you know.
There's no question. I was going to ask you about that, because the music, you tapped into nostalgia with the music. The music is very synth, and it has that kind of vibe to it. And I was like, oh, he's and obviously, you know, the old video games and the whatchamacallit, just the whole concept, the whole thing looked like it was something made out of the 80s.
Ball machine.
I mean, those kind of places are throwbacks from the 80s. I mean, they might still be around today, not as much today with COVID, but they're just throwbacks. That's when they started, and that's kind of and the creepiness, because if you look at those old places, and let's just call it's Chucky. So you look at Chuck E. Cheese and the giant rat and moving around in your it's freaky, dude. Yeah. And when I first saw the animatronic guys show, like when I first saw them on the screen, I'm like, oh, that's creepy as F. And the thing is that it just makes so much sense, because if you've ever been in a Chuck E. Cheese, and if you've been to an old school Chuck E. Cheese, like back in the like 90s Chuck E. Cheese.
Yep.
They're creepy, man. They were creepy. They were not. They weren't Disney-fied. They were just creepy as hell.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up with Showbiz Pizza. So it had like the Rockefeller explosion and all that. And I had so many birthday parties there and went to so many birthday parties there. And so when I read the script, I was like, this is Showbiz, man. And then it evolved into Chuck E. Cheese, right? And I got four kids. So two of them are teens. Two of them are 5 and 7. Two boys, two little guys. And so they've all gone to Chuck E. Cheese. And what's so funny is, you know, right before shooting, I was like, let's go to Chuck E. Cheese. I need to do research. And I'm like, I can't go alone or I'll be escorted out by the cops as a pedophile, right? Checking out little kids and their birthday party. So like, I need you kids now. You got to go. And it was just cool because I was really concerned with tapping into the psyche of these animatronics. Like you just said, they're creepy. But why are they creepy? Like what really – and I was watching kids and stuff, and then I was thinking about what I was through, and I was going on the net and looking at stuff, and I was like, the movie It was a great movie, but like, why are clowns creepy, you know, and stuff? And I think it's the ambivalence. I think it's that it's supposed to be this kiddie and friendly, but like with a clown, it's got the white face, right?
Dead.
And
it just feels like it's dead inside.
Dead eyes. Exactly. And the animatronics have these big eyes and mouth. There's music playing, there's audio playing, dialogue playing, but it's not synced up, right? The mouth's just moving, right? And the eyes are just blinking. And so Ken Hall did such a great job with the creatures. And that was one of my big things. I wanted big eyes and a mouth. And so he put pulleys inside the suits. It was stunt men and women in the suits. And they would move the pulleys and the eyes would blink and the mouths would open. That was big for me. because that to me showed that these are real animatronics. They weren't, you know, CG or puppets or whatever. And we didn't have, you know, it's funny starting out. It's like, well, are we going to build this animatronics? And it's like, yeah, we're going to have 8 R2-D2s on set with a remote control and an indie level film. Like, no way. Actually, what's kind of cool is I saw this Saturday Night Live skit, and it was with Tom Hanks. He was a guest star. It was Bill Hader, and they played this like pop and lock thing in this Tunnel of Love. And yes, the people come in. Remember, you saw it?
Saw that. That's creepy.
That's what I showed everybody. I said, we could do this. We get dancers or stunt people. We put them in the suits, and we'll make this work, you know? And so that was kind of my vision always. But I was so worried. I didn't want people to watch this movie going, ah, it's just got dudes in suits. It's guys and girls in suits. Like, this is lame. And so if you notice, like, I never shoot like really, really full frame until like the end, you know, because I wanted bits and pieces, and the lighting was very key. So that really kept me up at night, because I just didn't want these animatronics to look like, oh, it's just, there's just a bunch of, you know, puppets. You know, Algie was a puppet, but I didn't want them to look like just cheesy. You know, there was a Sigmund and the Sea Monster vibe I wanted, but I just didn't want to go all the way there. Right. And so we call this movie a tightrope movie. It really walks a fine line. It could have been a really bad movie, you know, some people think it is, but I just feel like, you know, yeah.
Everyone, when it comes to critics and people with their opinions of films, dude, I heard a great quote the other day. There's like, you should never take advice from someone about your film who's never made a film. And it's so true. My friend Noam said that, and it's so true, because at the end of the day, like, I'll read a quote about one of my films or all that, and I always tell people, like, you feel bad about reviews of your film, type in Shawshank Redemption, bad review. Type in Star Wars, bad review. Type in Godfather, bad review. I mean, I remember seeing Lucas on the set of Phantom Menace with a T-shirt of a bad review of Star Wars. Like, he literally printed the entire review on his shirt, and he's walking around with a bad review of Star Wars on his shirt. And he's like, I don't care. You know, like, how much crap has George gotten over the years?
You
know,
I mean,
people crap on Return of the Jedi. People crapped on, I mean, it's constant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Whether I like them or not, whether I like all the prequels or if I like the new ones, or it doesn't matter. It's the filmmaker's doing whatever the filmmaker's going to do. And it's art.
Yeah.
It's art, dude. It's art. And if you don't like it,
it's great. It's okay.
There's about 500 other pieces of content just created right now. Just as we were speaking, that was 500 pieces. Oh, there's another 500 pieces of content created. Oh, you can watch 1,000 things. It doesn't matter. Well,
you know what? You know what's interesting too about that too? A friend of mine was saying how, you know, he's not affected like, oh, they make a bad sequel or something. He goes, it doesn't ruin the other movie for me, because I still have that movie. I have that experience. Okay, it's not that movie, but it's so funny because some people go, oh my God, you just raped my childhood. You destroyed it. You know, whatever. And it's like, hey, you still have, if you didn't like the prequels or whatever, you still have New Hope, original Star Wars. You still have Empire or whatever. Why is like stuff, you know, coming? It's just like same thing with what we're dealing with Willie. Sometimes like, oh, this is Banana Splits or your Five Nights at Freddy. And it's like, why can't you just coexist everything? I think we help Five Nights at Freddy. I mean, I don't know anything about Five Nights at Freddy. You know, I really don't. My son's a gamer. He's 16. But I stayed away from it because I didn't want to be influenced by any of it, you know. And same thing with Banana Splits movie. I just watched it recently, you know. And it's like, okay, so, you know, now it's like I just think we could all coexist. So like you said, bad review, to me, everything helps. If, you know, Godfather comes out, people like it, they get Godfather 2, right? You know, and it's like, and for me with these reviews too, I love the audience, you know. Growing up, Siskel and Ebert, right? But now it's power to the people. It's power to the people. People like yourself with these great, you know, podcasts and stuff like that. And so I love reading these audience reviews because we've brought smiles and joy to a lot of people. And I just think that's so cool, you know, especially with what's going on with COVID and the political landscape. Like, just sit back and relax and have fun. Like, you know, like the movies, some movies we made in the 80s, man, they were just fun. You look at Return of the Living Dead, you know, I mean, come on, right? So that was the intention behind this.
Look,
you know?
Man, I'll tell you, anytime I get caught up in that kind of stuff, which as an artist you do, and anyone talks bad about your work, it does. But you just got to go to your, you just have to ask yourself, in 100 years, who cares?
No.
In 100 years, no one's going to care about what that person said. In 100 years, no one's going to remember Siskel and Ebert. People have already forgotten. Our generation remembers, you know, Siskel and Ebert. But they're already fading. You know, all these movies, you know, is anyone going to remember Cutthroat Island? Is anyone going to remember The Last Action Show in 150 years? Mm. Is anyone going to remember Arnold? Dude, Clark Gable was the biggest movie star in the world, and only a handful of real fans and older people really love him, or Charlie Chaplin. Like, you know, there, it's like in 500 years, who cares?
Yeah.
So do what you can while you're here, and that's all that matters. I was talking to a director the other day, and he said this really, really amazing thing. He's like, look, man, I don't care about someone talking about the films I make in 100 years. I care about making the movies I want to make right now and enjoying that ride and that experience, man. And that's all this is about. And if you don't like it, turn off the TV.
Yeah.
Go to Facebook. Do something else. Look, there's people who watched my last movie and they're like, oh, well, you know, he's trying to do this. I don't care, because the people who get it, it's for them.
Yes. Yes. And that's what it is. Like with Willie's, made it for them. I made it for all the fanboys and girls and the pop culture collectors like myself and you, you know, and it's like it would get this movie. And then there's some people that the title Willy's Wonderland, man, like you kind of know what you're getting into. It's pretty obvious, right?
I mean, it's either a porn or that's a great, by the way, great porn title. I mean, you have to say, they don't even have to change it for the porn parody. They can just straight up.
Do they still do porn parodies, by the way? I mean, that was like the biggest thing.
Oh, man. Back in the day when I used to play, this is years ago. I mean, intercourse with a vampire, Batman.
Indiana Jones and the Black Hole. That was like the one.
Indiana Bones in the Black Hole, if I remember. I worked in a video store, and I worked at two video stores in my youth. One of them had the curtain, you know,
Odyssey Video.
The saloon. It was either curtains or saloon doors. So one of them had it, one of them didn't. So I would sometimes go back there and I would hiss myself with these parodies, man. They were.
We did the same thing. We'd go in and laugh at Edward Penis Hands, and we just like, oh my God.
By the way, if no one's ever seen Edwin Penis Hands, do yourself a favor. Because there's not just one. There was like seven of them. Like he kept going. I remember I heard someone told me that Tim Burton got a copy of it and couldn't stop laughing. He was dying when he was watching it. Because it was like, I don't want to get into the craft of it, but he had the hands and the thing. And he was method. The actor was method. He had the whole Johnny Depp thing going. Like, it was so brilliant. It was so brilliant. Sorry, guys. We have gone. Well, look, we're talking about Willy's Wonderland. This is what's going to happen. I have to ask you one question, though, brother. Has Chuck E. Cheese called yet? Has Chuck E. Cheese called yet?
Well, Chuck E. Cheese, man, I feel bad for Chuck E. Cheese, man. You know, with COVID, I think it just put it under. You know what's interesting, too, Alex, was when I was telling you research at Chuck E. Cheese before I went and shot the movie, you could already see things changing. There were like three broken animatronics just sitting there like this, and they had a LCD screen, and it was like use your phone, and it had like the animated Chuck E. Cheese and stuff like that, and the kids were doing that, and you just saw like this is a new generation, man. Like they're not going to know the animatronics anymore, you know. You could just feel it.
No, I had my daughters when I go with I've been to way too many Chuck E. Cheese's in the last 5 years. Because for an adult, it's madness. It's madness. Yeah. It can only take it for so long. But for kids, it's great. And you would just see off in the back the dead animatronics. They're just that was what happened back then. But they just sitting there and they're dead. And that's what I think that's what kind of really Wonderland kind of tapped into is that thing. They were like, those guys in the back, they're gonna kill us now. Because you always in the back of your head are like. At any moment, that rat's going to jump off and just start stabbing kids. It was so much
fun. You know what's funny, too? What's kind of an in-joke I kind of got a kick out of is Frank Gabriel did the artwork for the movie. So all the cartoon, the animated Willies, I wanted to be like a Hanna-Barbera Woody Woodpecker, right? So like right. the t-shirt, right? And what was great is like, if you look at Chuck E. Cheese and even Showbiz and all these other places, the animation looks so different from the animatronics. Like you got the Chuck E. Cheese animation. It's like the cute mouse and with the buck teeth and whatever. And then you look at the freaking animatronic and it's like, he's scary. His foot, you know, his eyes, you know,
terrifying.
And I just always got a kick out of that. And so that was one of the things I want to do with our movie. So if you look at like Willie, you know, coming out, you know, hey friends, you know, that, and then you look at the animatronic Willie, the creature Willie, they look so different. Right. You know, and I just got a kick out of that. It was kind of an inside joke, but that's what these places are. I was real talk about Emwa too, who did the score.
Oh.
I mean, he did such a job in the voice of Willie. And in the script, Billy didn't have much of a voice. He did his birthday time and stuff, but he didn't really talk. And when Emwa was working on the score, he was just doing Willie as a placeholder, and we all loved it. And he just did such a fantastic job. And he did the birthday time song before we even shot. So it was so cool. Like, he did that, and he put it on a Chuck E. Cheese commercial. And he made the birthday time song, and I played it for Nick when I met him. And I kind of just showed it to him, and he dug it. And then when I was shooting all the animatronics, we had it, so we would play it on set. So it worked really well, and I knew it was a hit because the next day, you know, you'd have the cast and crew come in going, I can't get that damn song out of my head. It's just crazy, and it's creepy, and it's giving nightmares. You know, so he did such a great job, Emwa, you know, Six Little Chickens. And
it's, you know, awesome. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests, brother. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, that's a great question. You know, man, I've said this before. I'll just say it again. I just stay true to yourself. And I always picture like there's this road, right? And like, we're just all going on this road, this journey. And the road could be the creative journey of your script, of your story or whatever. And I know this sounds maybe corny, but I just feel like there's people on the side that are pushing you off the road, trying to push you off. And that could be change your story to meet this, or, you know, backstab your friend. You know, I mean, there's millions of stories, right? And you need to stay true to yourself. Movie making is about faith. You have to have faith in the material that you're doing, the story, the narrative, right? You have to have faith in the people you hire, you bring on as partners, as collaborators. And it's a team sport. It is not solo. And, you know, the days we talk about Kurosawa and all that, that's great and they're amazing. But you know what? More than ever, especially now, it is a team sport. And you need really good people, and you need to stay on that road and be true to yourself and be able to look yourself in the mirror. And the thing is, it's art and commerce, and sometimes they just don't meet, right? And this is the movie business, and we're not making poetry, you know, where we can just put it and shelve it and whatever. We are. When I was doing Willie's, I was thinking about the audience. And so, you know, if that's what you want to do, you know, you want to make, you know, little films or personal or whatever, you know that you're making it for an audience. And so you always should keep that in mind. But honestly, you know, Alex, you just have to have faith in the material, and stay strong and stay true to yourself.
Good answer, sir. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh man, that's a good question too. Yeah, I've got one. I love people. Okay. And I love listening to their stories. I love, you know, I always feel like it's really weird, like, about, you know, doing these things in the podcast and stuff, because I'm talking about, you know, all stuff, but I always like listening to other people. I love to listen to you for, you know, a couple hours about your history and whatever. So I love people. And making movies, again, it's like a family. And you get together and for a short period of time, and you create art, you create your film, whatever. And what I learned, and it was a hard lesson, but it's like, that was then, and this is now. And so just because you made a movie and you're with these people and whatever, you know, they have their lives and they go on, you know. And I used to think everybody was my friend, right? And I realized everybody has agendas, personal agendas. And it's hard, you know, because you think, well, we're all doing this together. And then you realize, no, they have an agenda. It's for them. They're manipulating this, you know, they're doing this to suit their needs. And it's a really hard thing to swallow sometimes. And these people that you think are your friends are not, you know? And so that was the hardest thing for me was, you know, we're all in this together and we're going through kind of a war. You know, my dad was in the military and Green Beret, you know, and he was always talking about Vietnam and he was talking about drive on the bullets. They won't mean nothing. And I'm not comparing movie making and war. Okay. It's two different things, but it is trust. It's in the foxhole with people that you need to trust. And there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of things going on. And, you know, like I said before, you have to stay true in things. And there's some people that just have agendas and that aren't your friends, you know? And so it's a tough thing to learn because, like I said, I thought everybody was like on the same page. This is starting out making movies, not now. I already know this, but you know, starting out, I just thought like everybody, you know, they want the same thing. We're all whatever. And it's not. And so I kind of lost a little bit of loving humanity, to be honest with you, because I was like, okay, now you have to be guarded. Now you have to, and now you see things, and now you can see why, you know, directors maybe don't want to sign an autograph because someone might put it on eBay, or you know what I mean? Like, there's just things like you see, and it's always, and it's usually to deal with money. I hate to say it, but you know, I told my kids, if you ever have a problem, you think of what, why someone's doing this or something happened, it's usually the dollar bill. So usually 9 out of 10. And I know that sounds, it's kind of bitter, but it's the truth. And I'm sorry to say. So, you know, don't mistake purity sometimes for the almighty dollar. And that's why I say art and commerce, very hard, you know, to congeal and for them to be one, you know, and unfortunately with the movie business, commerce usually wins. But we're talking about Kubrick, you know, and some of these other great filmmakers, and to me, art won, you know. So, anyways, that's a long way around it. But
yeah, you know. Absolutely, good answer, man. And the toughest question of all: three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay, favorite films of all time. So, Raiders of the Lost Ark was the movie that I saw where, I mean, Star Wars, just like you, like it was made by God. I didn't see George Lucas make this film. It was just like, and you know, let there be light. And by the way, here's Star Wars, right? But Raiders was the movie where I saw the camera, I saw the editing, I saw the pacing, I saw what a director really did. And then I'll take that a step further with Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, when it was with what Sam Raimi, how inventive he was with the camera and things like that. That's when I really started getting into filmmaking. So I have to say, you know, Raiders Lost Ark, you know, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, 2001, Apocalypse Now. You know what I love? I love the movie Witness. I love Peter Weir.
Peter Weir.
One of my favorite films. Oh, we need more movies by him. And I love Witness. And, of course, Blade Runner, you know? So that's just some of them.
I want to ask you, man. This is just off the path a bit, but like there are so many amazing directors who just stop. They don't give them the budgets anymore. They don't let them do, like Ridley's a special occasion. Okay, like he, you know, he's, what is he?
Yeah.
Like late 70s at this point. Spielberg, obviously Scorsese, you know, but at a certain point, someone takes the keys away. And it's sad because, you know, I would love to see another Peter Weir movie. I would love to see another Wolfgang Peterson movie.
You know,
like after Poseidon, he got thrown into director jail, and he hasn't come out of it since. So it's so hard sometimes to see these. You know, De Palma, he left. He's like, screw you all. I'm going to Europe where I can continue to make movies.
Yeah.
That's what Brian did. Brian's over there making his movies, and he's like, screw all Hollywood. Yeah. I don't want to deal with Hollywood anymore. I'm going to go off and do this. But man, it's so sad to see these are great artists that just get the key. I call it the keys are taken away from them. And it's so
appropriate what you just said. That really, that says it all right there. we could go on and on. I mean, I love like Bernard Rose with The Immortal Beloved, you know, like Alex Proyas with The Crow and Dark City. Like, we could go on.
I just had Alex on the show. So I talked to Alex. Alex is so awesome, dude. And when we were talking, he's like, yeah, you know, the kind of stories he wants to tell are $150 million experimental sci-fi films. You know, that's not the world we live in right now. So he's hustling it, but he's still being creative though. And some of these directors just he's doing shorts, like these insane shorts that he's doing. He's building out his own production facilities in Australia. He's still a young guy. He's not an old guy. He's still a young guy, but it's so sad to see some of these filmmakers that we grew up with, that are just, you know, that's why I love when George Miller showed up. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do Mad Max.
Oh yeah,
I'm gonna do Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh yeah,
and it's gonna look like a 25 year old did it, and the DP is like 70. I'm like 75, whatever how old he is.
Yep.
And I'm gonna make the coolest, most hip, most everything film anyone's ever seen, and screw all of you.
Yep.
And you heard that Donner's coming back, right? Richard Donner's coming back.
For I love it.
He's awesome. Weapon 5. He's the Weapon 5.
That's awesome.
90.
Bring it.
90.
Bring it, man. Bring it.
So awesome.
I love it. No, I'm with you. I remember seeing the Mad Max movie at the Cinerama Dome, and I was just blown away. I was like, wow, this is an instant classic. Like,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And then you go, this is the guy who did Happy Feet.
I know.
It's the guy who did Happy Feet. How can the director who did Happy Feet direct Mad Max Fury Road? Like, how is that even possible in your mind? He's an absolute genius. He's absolute.
And there's another thing I learned from a producer told me years back, but he's right. You got to be able to walk away. And whether it's the deal that you're getting or the studio or the people trying to, you know, change the story, or like you said, Alex Proyas not being able to make the movie that he really wants to make. Movie making, as you know, Alex, it takes a piece of your soul. Just like how you felt when you watched the bad movie, right? That movie, it really does. It takes a piece of your soul. You have to care about what you're doing. I'm not one of these guys. I just want to show up and let's go. Okay, great. Like, I'm not that. And so for me to do a project, I've got to invest 110%. And I'm sure you're the same. And so basically it's like, you know, you've got to love what you're doing. And someone like Alex Proyas, if he's not going to be able to do what he wants to do, it's better off he doesn't do it, because it'll just take him and it'll just rip him, man. You know, and that's why I think a lot of these directors we haven't heard from, because it's like, it's just like, what's the point? If Peter Weir can't be Peter Weir, right? Then why even go make the film? You know, like, there's no point, you know. And he tried that Master Commander. That was kind of his commercial film, and that just flopped, you know. And it's a great movie, you know. And so
it's a great movie.
Yeah. What they need is some studio exec to recognize what we're talking about. Someone like you and I who get in charge and just say, you know what, I want to give, you know, Peter Weir a shot. Here's, you know, whatever. And I hope that would have it. But unfortunately, in this day and age, with what's going on and a lot of the foreign countries driving the box office, and, you know, I mean, I love Marvel, man. I'm a huge comic book fan. I've got thousands of comic books. I've Silver Age, Bronze Age. On the set with Nick, I would talk about Neil Adams. This is the Neil Adams Superman 233, you know, and he'd get it. He knew it, right? I love comics. But honestly, Alex, like, I'm just getting tired of it. I'm just getting tired of... just, you know, sometimes comics just belong to be comics, man. Like, let's get original. It's so funny. A friend of mine, we watched The Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises. And I was like, bummed, because I was like, wow, no more Nolan doing Batman. And he's like, good. He's like, I want Nolan to do original stuff, you know. And, you know, out of that, we got Tenet, right? We got Dunkirk, and we're going to get whatever else. And he was right. Scott was right, you know. And, it's just, you know, but then you take like the Joker, right? And they make that. I thought Joker was an amazing movie, and they just turn it on its head, you know. And it's like, wow, that's really cool. I know it's Scorsese like and whatever, but we need more movies like that. Like, if you're gonna do that, be inventive, right? Not just do the comic book, you know. But we live in that world, man.
I know, man. But I think the only hope that there is for those kind of filmmakers, and I think it is happening, is like the Netflixes of the world and the Amazons of the world, because they don't know the rules. And they play by a different set of rules. Like, they don't care. That's why Netflix gives Martin Scorsese $200 million to de-age, you know, Pacino and Robert and Joe Pesci and all those guys. And whether you like The Irishman or not, I'm glad Marty got to make it. I'm glad that he got to make the movie he's working on right now with Leonardo DiCaprio for Netflix. Like, they gave him 150. Like, absolutely. I'm glad that those directors get to make these films that you just wouldn't. You won't see. You would never have seen The Irishman, whether you like it or not. I want Marty to do whatever Marty wants to do, man. Like, let him free. You know, let him loose, if you will. Let him loose. But there is hope. There is hope. But but we'll see how the whole world is just changing so rapidly, man. But listen, brother. I know we could keep geeking out for at least another 2 hours.
I know.
But thanks for being on the show, man. You know, congratulations on the success of Willy's Wonderland, man. I'm glad it's. I say when I see films like this, I'm like, I'm glad it's in existence. Like, I'm glad this needed to be birthed into this world. I don't care if you like it, you don't like it. I'm glad it's alive. I'm glad it's there. It's like Mars Attack.
Great.
When I watched Mars Attack, Tim Burton's Mars Attack, I walked out of it and people were like, "Oh, it's so bad." I'm like.
Yeah,
I just am happy that it was made. Like, there's certain movies you're like, I'm just glad somebody was crazy enough to gather the resources and birth this into the universe. So I feel the same way about Willy's Wonderland, man. So I appreciate you being on the show, man. Continued success, brother.
Thank you.
I want to thank Kevin for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Kevin. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/461. And can we all agree that Nicolas Cage is a national treasure? I mean, let's just put it out there. Nick Cage is a national treasure, and I appreciate everything that Mr. Cage does. And hopefully one day soon, we will have Nick Cage on the show. I'm not promising anything. I have no contacts to him, but I'm hoping one day that Nick will bless us on this show. And God, I would have some amazing questions for him. But anyway, if you guys haven't done it already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.